You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past several months, exchange rates for global currencies like the dollar and the euro have taken wild swings, the likes of which haven't been seen in years. When the value of money becomes that volatile, its impact can be felt on everything from the goods you buy to international relations to the length and severity of the global recession. Mark Chandler is the head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman and an associate professor at New York University. He spends much of his time thinking about money, from where it goes to what it's worth, and he joins me now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's a real honor.
In the December issue of The Economist, someone wrote, "Currencies are national virility symbols." Do you think that's a fair description?
Probably not. I mean, I think that in some ways, currencies are just what they are. It's really just a dimension of money. And I think it's problematic when countries attach their egos, their collective egos, to the value of their currencies, which are fluctuating in the foreign exchange market.
Well, that changed in Europe with the euro, didn't it? Although I'm sure there's some people who still regret the switch over to the euro.
Yes, in fact, that's one of the key issues right now in the foreign exchange market is the euro. A dozen countries in Europe got together to share a common currency, and for 10 years it's worked. But now there's strains approaching, and apparently strains that people are saying maybe it's not going to last much longer.
You think the euro might be dissolved?
I don't think it will, but there are a lot of people who are wagering quite the opposite. There's this great website where people can bet on policy decisions. And right now that website attributes about a 1 in 3 chance that some country drops out of the eurozone by the end of next year, by the end of 2010.
And what would lead to that? Dissatisfaction with the way, with foreign exchange, with tourism?
Well, I would put it a little differently. I'd say that what's happened is that the businessmen and women in Germany have kept a very tight control on wages when adjusted for productivity, what economists call unit labor costs. And because German unit labor costs haven't changed all that much, but many countries within the European community, like Spain or France or Italy, they tie their wages to, they get these cost of living adjustments, which sometimes outstrip productivity. So many of these countries are losing competitiveness to Germany. In the past, they would devalue. They can't devalue now, so the economy and interest rates bear that burden.
Well, does a weak euro mean different things for different countries in the European Union? For example, might a weak euro be welcomed by economists in France but cause someone to be upset in Ireland?
Yeah, no, you raise a good point. This is why many people think that the euro is fundamentally flawed, because you've got a common currency for a group of countries that don't share necessarily the common economic fundamentals, different inflation rates, different management, labor relations. And so some exporters, for example, might think that they benefit from a weaker currency, while importers might want a stronger currency.
I would think that a weak euro would have been welcomed by the French at a time when Americans had more money. Now it's not going to spur American tourism.
Yeah, I think that the problem right now is because we saw this really with the British numbers that came out earlier today. The British pound's been falling on a trade-weighted basis for the past 2 years. You would expect sort of Econ 101 would lead us to believe that the British should have a smaller trade deficit. But in fact, the trade deficit's growing because there's not a demand for their goods at a time when the global recession is hitting.
David Bloom of HSBC, which is British, isn't it, has been quoted as saying, "We're now in an unconventional world where you're getting huge movements that are no longer grounded in conventional models."
Yeah, I'm not so sure if that's true. I used to work with David Bloom, and he's a very smart currency strategist. I would say that oftentimes economists and strategists like myself, when we don't get it right, we blame the system rather than our own analytic tools. And I think that the dollar's appreciation since the summer has been fundamentally understandable and follows economic logic, but of a peculiar kind. And what's happened is for many years, from 2000 basically until middle of last year, many people were using the dollar as a financing currency. By that I mean they would borrow it and then sell it and buy a higher yielding asset. And what happened last summer as the financial crisis hit, it was a deleveraging process. The dollar suffered as people were building up the leveraging and then benefited when the deleveraging kicked in. And so I think it's understandable, even if it is extreme.
So it was kind of like a bear market in currency in the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, in some ways I'd say that from roughly speaking 2000, 2001, the dollar fell consistently against a whole range of currencies, including the emerging markets.
But isn't the exchange rate of the dollar at least in part determined by how the Federal Reserve manipulates interest rates?
That's an interesting question. That is to say that since currencies are price of money and so are interest rates, isn't there a relationship?
And when they lower interest rates, or have in the past, suddenly the stock markets all over the world started doing better for a little while.
Yeah, I'd say that the relationship between that interest rate story and what happens in the dollar is related, but sometimes not in a linear way. For example, the strongest currency since early last year has been the Japanese yen, and they have even lower interest rates in the U.S., and by many measures, even a worse economy.
Well, I want to get into that in just a moment, but how can they have lower interest rates in the U.S.? Isn't the U.S. interest rate right now hovering around zero? It doesn't give us much leeway.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question, because for most of this past several years, Japanese overnight interest rates have been at 50 basis points. Ours would just cut to 0 to 25 basis points, and Japan cut theirs, so they're at 20 basis points now. So it's very close to the same level now, but over the past couple of years, Japan had lower interest rates and a stronger currency.
So why is Japan doing so well at a time when it's not doing well?
Yeah, I think that's the ironic thing. Sometimes you can have, and many of your listeners are probably familiar with the stock market, where you can have a company that's not showing any earnings, but yet still have a strong stock, or a company that's a solid company that has a weak stock for a while, weak share prices. Similarly with currency.
Is this about confidence, then?
I think partly about confidence, and partly the reason that the yen is strong is the same reason the dollar was strong against all the other currencies, and that's because people use the yen as a financing currency. Such low interest rates, you could borrow it cheaply, use it to buy U.S. treasuries, and lock in a very attractive yield for many years.
Is this partly the result of the financial crisis that Japan has gone through for quite a few years now?
I think it's more like structural, in the sense that what happens is capitalism, our way of producing goods and services, is so successful. There's so much money in the system that's sloshing around. And when it doesn't know what to do sometimes, and there's not productive outlets to build a factory or to expand capacity, they turn to speculation, or what Hyman Minsky, an economist of the, say, 50s and 60s, talked about balance sheet engineering. And so I think a lot of this money that's flowing in the markets is really speculative in nature.
What other data are you looking at when you're developing a currency strategy for the dollar at Brown Brothers Harriman?
Well, I'd say that's, for me, one of the most intellectually challenging things about the foreign exchange market is that when one buys a bond or a stock, one is buying a claim on a future earnings stream. When one buys a currency, it's not so clear what one is buying, since in their pure form, they have no yield stream. You have to turn them into a time deposit to get that earnings stream. And so various factors. We look at interest rates. We look at shapes of yield curves. That is a distance between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. We look at equity markets. We look at performances of relative asset classes. We look at market flows. What are the speculators doing? What are the hedge funds doing? What are the corporations doing? So we have to have informal but very complicated approach, looking at many variables.
Do you look at social or political factors in a country as well?
I'd say generally we look at policy, which seems to be increasingly political. But I'd say that in general, for the major industrialized countries, it doesn't matter so much which political party's in place as if the dollar likes Democrats in the White House or likes Republicans in the White House. I think it's much more complicated than that.
But you mentioned Germany earlier. It's been slow to respond to this economic crisis, and that's been in part the result of political ideology.
I'm not sure if it's political ideology or whether it's for me. I think of it in terms of policy. Slow to respond. Partly they have a coalition government. They also are very. They don't want to be slaves to the market the way they criticize Anglo-American capitalism for doing. And so their approach. It's not just the current configuration, but even going back generations, going back to other crises, say that Europe's had. Europe is similar to this kind of response.
My guest is Mark Chandler, head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman, associate professor at NYU. We are talking about the impact of changing exchange rates and the like on the economy and on international trade. What about phrases like the strong dollar and weak dollar? Do they refer only to exchange rates?
Well, I think there's this, you know, many people are confused by this concept of a strong dollar because Robert Rubin becomes
Treasury. I'm confused about Robert Rubin.
Yes, Treasury Secretary back in 1995, and he began talking about the strong dollar policy as strong dollars in U.S. interest. But yet, he authorized intervention once after 95, and that was to sell the dollar against the Japanese yen. His successor, Lawrence Summers, also authorized intervention once, and that was to sell the dollar against the euro. So what does a strong dollar mean? I think it's a signal to tell our trading partners and our creditors that the U.S. will not purposely seek devaluation to reduce our debt burden.
But hasn't the dollar been relatively weak compared to other currencies during the years that President Bush has been in the White House?
Yes, the dollar bottomed. I should say the dollar peaked back in 2000 on a trade-weighted basis, and it's been falling. It's been falling basically for the better part of the last 7 or 8 years.
But was that a goal of the Bush economic team?
I think that the dollar is not in itself a policy objective. I think it's a residual of other policies and of other things that beyond the president's control, beyond U.S. control.
Now, is having a weak dollar all that bad? First of all, wasn't it the weak dollar responsible for the high number of foreign tourists in New York this past summer?
Yes, I think that we often think, and this is, gets back to your, like your first question about like the tying the national character, pride, to a currency. I think that the point would be that this, that the strong, no country really gets rich by having a falling currency. I think that a weak dollar at some points in the business cycle is helpful to the U.S., not so much because it helps exports or because it helps tourism, which is relatively small in the billions of dollars. We just had a trade deficit this morning, $49 billion. And so a couple hundred million dollars from tourists is a lot of money for New York City, but not really for the macroeconomy as a whole.
Well, it might have helped U.S. exports in the past, but we pretty much eliminated our manufacturing sector, so there's not much to trade, is there?
Well, no, I think that this is probably one of the misconceptions. The U.S. is producing more goods before this recession, more goods than ever before. What's happened is we're doing with fewer people. The most successful textile factories in the world are in the Carolinas. They just hire very few workers. And that's what productivity means, increasing the output per like hour of effort. And so I think that the U.S. manufacturing sector, oddly enough, is bigger than the whole Chinese economy. But we use a very small part of our labor force to produce these goods.
So we're not having an economic boom as a result because we're not spreading, getting as big a bang for our buck.
Yeah, I would put it a little differently. I would say that the way the U.S. contribution to empire is building locally, selling locally. The way U.S. Companies service foreign markets is not by exporting, the way the world's biggest exporter will export over $1 trillion worth of goods this year. I would say the U.S. contribution to empire, building locally, selling locally. So the affiliates of the U.S. multinationals abroad will sell more than $4 trillion worth of goods this year. That's the primary way we service foreign markets. And by doing that, it leads to jobs abroad as well as jobs here. It also leads to technology transfers, development in parts of the world to buy more of our goods.
It makes it sound like we should be doing a lot better than we're doing.
Well, no, I think that, of course, we have a serious financial crisis and a deep recession that we suspect we probably lived through the worst of it already, but there's still more bad news to come in Q1 of this year. But probably by the end of this year, we'll see the U.S. economy begin recovering. And that's really the point, really. For 1,500 years before current times, there was no growth. There was stasis. One did what one's fathers did. One did what one's mothers did. One did not really have a great material wealth. Very stasis. So with capitalism comes growth, but it's not smooth growth. It's uneven, and crisis comes from it.
You seem to be predicting recovery a lot quicker than most people are.
Well, I would say that there's a doom and gloom camp out there that says that the model that was created in roughly 3 years, 1978, Tao Zemin comes to power in China, representing not just China, but the emerging markets as a whole. Margaret Thatcher comes to power in the U.K. in 1979, Ronald Reagan in the U.S. in 1980. Those 3 years, those three people, helped basically build this big cash register. And we followed it further and needed some kicking and some tweaking along the way. But now many people are saying that cash register is broken and we need a new cash register. I'm in a camp that says it's sort of like a phoenix rising, sort of like I would compare it to the junk bond market. You know, back in the late 80s, the junk bond market was run out of one man's drawers, literally. And
he later wound up in prison.
Prison for those drawers. And now the junk bond market, or the high yield bond market, the bona fide asset class that's legitimate, there's dedicated users of it, there's a dedicated function of it. And I think that's partly what's happening now is we have this financial crisis, and the way we resolve things in modern capitalist economies is through crisis, like a snake molting its skin. It goes through identity crisis, and it emerges stronger and better than before.
And you think that all the predictions of new regulations and the like are unnecessary?
Oh, no. I think that...
Is that going to fuel this recovery, do you think?
I think so. I think the difference between a... I saw this expression someone used in a newspaper that I like. I can't think of who to attribute it to, but it was the idea that the difference between a barroom brawl and a boxing match are rules. And that's what we need now. Our type of capitalism turned into a barroom brawl, and what we really want is a boxing match.
My guest is Mark Chandler, who's an associate professor at NYU and also head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Mark Chandler, head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman, an associate professor at New York University. Many currencies are pegged to the dollar, and oil prices have been pegged to the dollar. What does that mean exactly?
I think this really illustrates one of the very important functions of the dollar, that irregardless of its movement in the foreign exchange market against the euro or the yen, that is, the dollar has a certain role in the world economy. We call it the numerator. That is, it's the global benchmark that not only is oil priced in dollars, but many grains, many commodities are priced in dollars. The reason that we do this is that it gives producers and suppliers a common currency rather than a whole matrix of different currencies to be valuing things in.
But we hear again and again threats to take oil off of the dollar, move it to another standard, euro. You're saying the euro's in so much trouble that people might have second thoughts about that now?
Not only that, but I'd say there is talk every so often, as you point out, that some oil-producing country wants to denominate their oil in some other currency. And today, Venezuela and Iran price their oil, sell their oil, say, to the Japanese in yen terms. But these are exceptions to the rule. And I would hardly think that Venezuela and Iran really are leaders in the among oil producers. I think that the key to watch is Saudi Arabia. Regardless of the elements in politics, we deal with them. I think when it comes to currencies, they have done more for a strong dollar policy than maybe we have ourselves.
But maybe not Qatar or... One or Dubai's currency or Saudi currency?
Yeah, those currencies are all tied to the dollar. And the interesting thing is what they call themselves the Gulf Cooperation Council. It's about five of these oil-producing countries are moving towards a currency union. They tell us that by the end of next year, they will adopt a single currency, which means Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Dubai, UAE, all adopt a single currency, partly encouraged by what happened in Europe.
So they may very well switch over from the dollar.
Well, no, they would peg their individual currencies except for Kuwait to the U.S. dollar. Soon they're going to have one currency, and then it's not clear what they tie it to, but they could tie it to a basket of currencies of which the dollar would still be the key component.
Do you think that we might need a new Bretton Woods conference?
I think you raise an important question. Bretton Woods comes at the end of World War II to set up the global monetary regime, because what policymakers were most afraid of at the end of World War II were two things: the spread of communism and a return to the Great Depression. The problem, though, is that what took place at Bretton Woods was possible for a couple of reasons. One of them is that the U.S. had all the gold, literally and figuratively. And so the U.S. with Harry Dexter White at the Treasury and Keynes, the British economist, negotiating, the U.S. were able to, for the most part, dictate the terms. And as many people think that because we've moved more into a multipolar world, that makes it more likely to happen. But I think that because we're in a multipolar world, or more of a multipolar world, it's harder to get that kind of agreement. Someone's got to come with the rules of the game and enforce them on everybody else, and we're not there yet.
And we're not in a position to dictate anything any terms to the rest of the world these days.
Not only are we not in a position to ideologically, but I don't think we're in a position economically to, and also like politically in terms of strong leadership.
Is there a particular relationship between the Chinese currency, the yuan, and the dollar, because they seem to be so tied together?
Yeah, for many years, the Chinese currency was pegged to the U.S. dollar the same way that the Saudis pegged their currency to the dollar. But back in July of 2005, they decided to let their currency float a little bit. And I mean, like, we call it a dirty float. They let it move, but it's highly managed. And so there is a relationship between China and the U.S. dollar. The dollar plays a very big role in their basket. They don't tell us what's in the basket, but they tell us the dollar plays a big role in there. They also have a lot of treasuries and U.S. agency bonds. They're probably the largest holder outside the United States of these bonds.
Do you think they prefer a weak or a strong dollar?
There's very little doubt in my mind that they prefer a strong dollar. They prefer a strong dollar. They prefer a strong U.S. Even though we think of China as an adversary, China has done very well by growing and modernizing its economy within the context of the U.S. economy being still the dollar being the numerator.
Well, hasn't China been accused in recent years of being a currency manipulator?
Now, that's a very the word manipulation has a very specific meaning, and that's really one of the points would be that the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before it has never found China guilty of manipulating the currency market. They have to make a finding. The Treasury Department makes a finding twice a year, and they haven't found China. They haven't found any country guilty of manipulation in several years. During the campaign, Obama had suggested that China might be manipulating the currency, and he pulled back from that later, appreciating the legal meaning of that word. Because if you say a country is manipulating their currency, it allows for lawsuits for retaliation. And we don't want to really open up that door. Otherwise, we get into the other side of the Great Depression, of the Smoot-Hawley and protectionism.
Well, you mentioned earlier that China owns a lot of our debt. It is the largest holder of our debt. Are you concerned that it's loss in sales as a consequence of the economic downturn will make it harder for Obama's recovery package to be sustained because China will be more reluctant to buy U.S. debt?
Well, it's funny you should ask. On the 15th, roughly the 15th of every month, the U.S. government releases this thing called the TIC report. That's the Treasury International Capital Report. And it tells us by country who's buying and selling our assets. And there's a two-month lag behind the data. It's the government. They're a bit slow. And what happens is that month in and month out, China is a buyer of U.S. assets. Sometimes they don't buy so many treasuries. They buy more agencies or corporate bonds. The most fickle investors in U.S. assets are Americans ourselves, putting our 401k money, chasing overseas returns, or getting annoyed at politicians and selling U.S. treasuries. We are the fickle buyers. China is a steadfast buyer because they have no other market that's deep enough and broad enough to absorb the billions of dollars that they're accumulating in savings.
But if they don't have if their earnings are diminished, they're less likely to want to buy dollars, aren't they?
Yes, that's an important question. That is that countries in East Asia, not only China, but have these huge trade surpluses, and they've been recycling those surpluses into buying U.S. debt. And what happens when those trade surpluses fall? They have less demand for those U.S. obligations. But so far, we're in the middle of a huge, because of the financial crisis, we have a lot of debt being sold now. And so far, I'd say that the Asian demand for U.S. debt seems to be holding up fairly well, despite the smaller trade surpluses.
My guest is an associate professor at New York University and also head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman, Mark Chandler. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, we just heard that many analysts are talking about the possibility of a $1 trillion budget shortfall this year on top of a national debt that's over $10 trillion. And you can only wonder what impact that might have on the country and the value of the dollar. The U.S. Treasury and the Fed have vowed to print as much money as possible to turn around the economy. Is that a good idea? I mean, isn't that what the Weimar Republic did?
Yeah, no, it sounds very scary, but I think that on one hand, it's sort of like it reminds me of the guy who's on his way to the guillotine worrying about his haircut. Urgent things and there's important things. And right now, policymakers are focused on what's urgent, leaves aside a little bit of what's important to address at a later date. I think that partly, for me, I'd say that it's partly relative. While the U.S. is printing a lot of money, I think so are other countries. Other countries are also cutting interest rates to near zero. Japan, as I mentioned, near zero. Swiss National Bank is at 50 basis points. We expect the European Central Bank to cut rates later this week. The Bank of England cut rates aggressively last week. And so I think that it is scary to think that how serious this economic problem is. But I think that because the U.S. has been very aggressive on monetary policy, fiscal policy, and then give me that big drop in oil prices from $140 a barrel now to less than $40 a barrel, I think these three factors, policy plus a drop in oil prices, give me it's a probabilistic world. I think the higher probability we get the recovery first in the United States, later elsewhere.
Did you see the 60 Minutes report on why oil prices go up and down?
I saw part of it.
They're saying it's pretty much not manipulation, but speculators on the commodities markets and has little to do with supply and demand.
Yeah, I think that it's not like speculators flip a coin and decide whether they should buy or sell. They're trying to make money. And speculators that don't make money get driven out of business. And the reason that's what speculators will do is they'll look at supply and demand, they'll look at political factors, they'll look at a whole host of factors. And I would say that we talk about speculators, I think speculators has a bad name, partly because they're seen, I think, as parasites on the system. But what they help do, I think, is besides providing the liquidity, they keep us honest. When policymakers say, try to sell us snake oil, they're telling us that snake oil, there's like no wizard behind the curtain.
But if we are paying $200 a barrel for oil because of these speculators, and then $40, and the supply of oil is the same, it would suggest something rotten is happening, not only in Denmark, but right here on Wall Street and then in Chicago.
Yeah, I would say that it's hard to show to demonstrate speculators, I think, played a very big role in oil or in other markets. They do have a role to play. I think sometimes they do get exaggerated, but I've seen like real investors. It's hard for me to draw a line. What I do with my 401k, I might invest it in European stocks or U.S. stocks, but isn't that speculating as well? And so it's a very fine line. And I think that people who want to say that oil prices weren't justified at 140 but are justified at $40 a barrel want to talk about speculators pushing us up. But I think that there's a big thing that happened between the summer when we peaked in oil and today. And that, I'd say, is the world economy looks like it fell off a cliff.
What's the impact of a strong or weak currency on trade relations? The Washington Post reported on January 8th that in the first part of 2009, the Australian dollar, and we're just starting that first part of 2009, the Australian dollar lost 10% against the Swiss franc. Can a fluctuation like that impact economic growth in places other than Australia and Switzerland?
Yeah, I think what happens is that the currency fluctuation, I put it like this, here's what the policymakers wanted to do. After the Great Depression, policymakers wanted to smooth out the real economy to avoid these big booms and busts. And so what they did was they pushed this volatility into the financial market, into interest rates and currencies. And now those volatility is having a feedback loop and hitting the real economy. So the fluctuation, when we talk about it in the United States and the IMF and the G7, they say we want countries to adopt flexible currencies. Many countries hear those words and they think what we're saying, what they interpret it to mean, is volatile currencies. And it's the volatility of the currency that's more deadly, that's more troublesome for policymakers and investors and businesses than a smooth trend.
Well, what happens in countries where the local currency has collapsed, like Iceland? Much of Iceland's banking system is in ruins, and the country currently has one of the highest inflation rates in the world at 17%. Are we likely to see any prospects for an economic recovery there anytime soon?
Well, I think that in some ways, in Iceland's case, a sharp decline in the currency is going to help them reduce their current account deficit. You know, we worry about the current account deficit in the United States when it's about 6%. Iceland's got close to 20%. And so what does Iceland have? They're going to be one of the global capitals of aluminum production, but in the short run, they have cod, fish. Those terms of trade, no matter how many cod they produce, it's just not going to buy them enough computers. And so I think the currency shift affects what we call the terms of trade. But so I won't worry about the U.S. going down the same path as Iceland. Iceland was like a country, but it was like a large hedge fund.
So the problem is that their major commodity cod just doesn't earn them enough? Why was that not a problem 10 years ago?
Well, when people are anxious to lend money and when people are attracted to high interest rates, a country like Iceland does well. Look what happened in the U.S. at the end of last year. U.S. T-bills were traded at negative interest rate. What that tells me is people, investors, would rather be sure of a small loss than the unknown of a larger loss. And so sometimes it's sort of like what Will Rogers said, the American vaudeville hero. He said, sometimes the return of your money is more important than the return on your money. And that's one of the times we're going through.
The Russian ruble has lost a lot of value against the dollar and the euro. Does that have anything to do with declining oil prices?
Yes, I think that, you know, here in the United States, many people would say that what caused the Soviet Union to collapse, they would say, is Ronald Reagan's arms race. And I don't believe that. I don't think the Russians believe that. I would suggest to you that what they believe is that the low price of oil back in the late 80s went below $10 a barrel. When Russia invaded Georgia in early August, the bloom was already off oil. But, of course, Putin didn't know that. And now with oil prices a third of what they were then and lower, that this undermines Russia's ability to project its power, not just in Europe, but in terms of causing trouble elsewhere for us.
Well, do you think that the recent crisis between Russia and the Ukraine over natural gas shipments will have an impact on the value of the ruble?
Not really. I think that for the most part, if I understand what's going on between Russia and the Ukraine, it's two oligarchs, an oligarch in the Ukraine and an oligarch in Russia who run Gazprom, who they really fight over. I think we saw this last year as well. I don't think it has any sustained impact except for giving us in the West greater incentive to find alternative routes for our gas and oil than to go through Russia.
Because if I were in Germany and suddenly I lost my natural gas, I might be pressuring my government to find alternative sources. And yes, that this could hurt Russia in the long run, couldn't it?
Yes, I think that's why Russia plays a dangerous game. I think Russia knows that. That's why these little spats with Ukraine get resolved relatively quickly. But remember, a lot of Russia's gas and oil is not denominated in rubles or euros. It's denominated in dollars.
Now, as I understand it, you have a book coming out this year?
I have a book coming out August of this year, published by Bloomberg Press, and our working title is called Making Sense of the Dollar, Exposing Dangerous Myths of Trade and Foreign Exchange.
And will it be covering the things we've been discussing?
It's going to cover the things we've been talking about, putting in a larger context. It's sort of built in some ways like the Freakonomics book, if I will. It basically has, I look at different things that I think are myths about the foreign exchange market or trade, like a falling dollar should help exports. Uh-huh. And I look at that and I show why it's more complicated or just simply wrong.
But I'm still not 100% clear on why a falling dollar shouldn't help exports. Obviously, if we're not charging as much, people are more likely to want to buy our product.
Well, you raise a couple good points there. First, just because the dollar falls, it doesn't mean we change the price of our product. Secondly, I'd say that because we produce a lot of our goods overseas, we don't really need to. We have an export base. People buy our goods not because they're necessarily just cost competitive, but because there's no alternative to Microsoft Windows or, I guess I'm learning now, Vista. There's no alternative to these. And so I think that the reason that the falling dollar doesn't help exports as much as people would think is that, one, is we build a lot locally. Second reason is that it depends about a corporate treasurer's policy. How much of the shift in currency do they pass on? How much do they hedge? And lastly, I'd say that it's also a question of invoicing. All of our imports are invoiced in dollars, and all of our exports are invoiced in dollars, roughly 95% or something like that. So that means when the dollar falls or rises, our trade, it takes a long time for it to really impact trade.
But if I understand you correctly, you're also saying that trade prices aren't affected if you have a unique product. It only becomes a problem, as Boeing experienced recently, when there's serious competition elsewhere.
Yes, I think commodities are much more difficult, but it's also not just what you produce, how you produce it, and because the U.S. has, perhaps, as the French would argue, overdeveloped financial system, we've got a lot of instruments in which companies and investors can protect themselves from the fluctuations in currencies. They don't have to pass them on to the end user.
Looking forward to the future, what impact do you think that Barack Obama's new stimulus plan will have on the economy? Have you gone over it?
Gone over parts of it. As far as the details, as far as we know, it still seems to me that there's room for lobbying to help shape it. And, of course, when it gets submitted to Congress, if I understand his advisors right, they purposely lowballed, whatever that means for a $750 billion initial offering, they lowballed it because they knew Congress would put their own pork and own programs into it. I think that a fiscal stimulus this size is very daunting. Many of us haven't seen anything like this in our lifetimes. But when the United States is committed to doing something, I think we have to make a bet as investors. Do we bet against City Hall? Do we fight City Hall? Or do we bet with them? And in the long run, I think better off betting with City Hall.
Did you see the letter to today's New York Times that advised the Obama administration to simply take Paul Krugman's advice on all matters?
Yeah, I teased Paul Krugman that he thinks that he would be Treasury Secretary under a Gore regime, which is not going to happen.
Because Al Gore is not going to be running. Well, he wouldn't be running anyway, but I think he told us on the show that he's no longer interested in becoming president. But you're suggesting that his ideas would have been more appropriate at a different time?
Perhaps at a different time. I'd say the person to follow is really one of his students, Laura Tyson, who is I believe she's the dean of the London Business School. I'd say her and her professor had a falling out, and she's a bit more activist on trade policy.
What about the debate over whether tax cuts are a good idea or whether you should have job creation instead?
Yeah, I think that here in the United States, it's hard for me to say this since I'm one of these people who were in the upper my wife and I both work, so we're in the upper levels of income in the country, and we both voted for Obama, and we're willing to get taxed for it. So I guess I'm sort of teaching my own book here, and that is that I think America generally undertaxes ourselves for the kind of goods that we get from the government. Other countries tax at a much higher rate and seem to be fairly as successful as we are as far as economic prowess goes.
The Scandinavian countries have very high taxes, and people have the highest standard of living.
Higher standard of living and more egalitarian. One of the interesting things about the Scandinavian countries, which gets to the heart of it, I think, because money measures are misleading. The average height of rich people and poor people in the Scandinavian countries has practically been closed, while in the U.S. and even in Britain, you still got a few inches. And so I think that also speaks to the quality of these social programs.
I hope people don't get the wrong idea. I'm 6'1", and that is no indication of what I earn.
No indication of what you earn. But it does indicate, increasingly, economists find that comparing money over time is very difficult. So we're beginning, even as a currency strategist, we're beginning to look at these body mass indexes that the UN and the World Bank put out.
So do you think that Americans should redefine their ideas of things like prosperity?
Well, I would put it this way, that I think that oftentimes the moralists among us complain that American families, we don't live within our means, the government doesn't live within our means, and they take those means as for granted. But I'll give you an example. My father was not college educated. He was a plumber, a tradesman. He worked for one employer his whole life, essentially, and he earned enough to support a family of four and a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm.
But after the early 1970s, wages and productivity and inflation became decoupled. Our income did not keep pace with the American dream. And I don't think the American dream is so ostentatious. What are we talking about? A car? Kids in college? A house? And the means became, the American dream became too expensive for people. So we got the American dream to, we were able to buy the American dream by household working more hours. That's women entering the workforce. Men and women working. Children working. Teenagers working at an earlier age. And, of course, also by borrowing. But I think that the morality doesn't lie in living outside your means. It lies in how those means are determined in the first place.
Well, two things have happened recently. One, part of that American dream, the house, has become a real problem that really started this economic crisis, making it easier for people to buy houses. But what we're seeing now is many people feeling that unions have been weakened over the past few decades, that unions are going to have to give even more givebacks because they're the ones who are the cause of all the problems.
Yeah, I know. For me, this is the part of the tail trying to wag the dog. First, and when you think about who bought homes who shouldn't afford them, we're talking about $1.4 trillion, roughly, subprime mortgage market, 10% of the mortgage market, yet world equity markets have lost over $35 trillion. Surely we're not talking about Obama spending $750 billion to cover up a 1.4 subprime problem. It's much bigger than that. I would say that it's not borrowers, homeowners, that cause the problem. I'd say it's this other thing, a dirty word, leverage. That is, think about what happened to Bear Stearns. They took a 5% drawdown on their assets and it wiped them out. How can that be? Well, they were leveraged 30-1. So for me, the leveraging is the real culprit here, not people who borrowed money who ought not to have.
And that was because of loosening of regulations?
Loosening of regulations. We lost some of those, and there's also other things like practices like originate and distribute. That is, one group of people made the loans, another person had to keep them, had to wear them in effect. They sold my mortgage is not the bank that, the person who owns my mortgage is not the bank who lent me the money, it's somebody else. So why should the bank have so much of a vested interest whether the loan was good? And so I think that a lot of these practices, we're going to reform these practices.
It's interesting when I think about history that Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, was the president who probably instituted the first real serious regulations to control business practices. And the country boomed for quite a while. We did have the Depression, but many years later. even though there were some people say it was because of lack of regulations. But still, regulations actually help business to some degree, and yet business is constantly opposed to it.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the lightning bolts of insight that Alan Greenspan had when he was testifying before Congress. He said there was a flaw, perhaps, in his ideology. He thought banks could protect their, they knew what their self-interests were. And I think that's part of the problem. It's sort of like what that American comedian said once. He said, it's not so much what we don't know that hurts us. It's what we know that just ain't so.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. By the way, a listener wrote in, thanks to you for explaining clearly what she hasn't been able to wrap her mind around until now. My thanks to Mark Chandler, and Suki, I guess, also is thanking him. He's the head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman, associate professor at New York University. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.